Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Weekly Pulse Podcast. I'm Jeff Snyder, the founder of The Morning Pulse, and your host for the next 60-plus minutes as we go around the globe analyzing the news and retirement, the markets, technology, personal finance, healthcare, so much more. Boy, spring has sprung, and do we have a great show for you this week. Joining us as a special guest, we're going to be talking healthcare with senior healthcare reporter Lydia Ramsey. She's from Business Insider. She's got the latest scoop on drug prices and the documentary about Theranos. You're not going to want to miss it. And we also have a special guest joining us. I'm going to tell you who. We've got a new member of the team contributing. I think you're going to love who we got, and it's going to be amazing. So, well, what can I say? Sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of The Weekly Pulse. Well, let's kick things off, as we always do, by taking a look at the latest social media trends. On the line from LinkedIn is the senior finance editor there, Mr. Devin Banerjee, CFA. Hey, Devin, how are you?
I'm doing well, Jeff. How are you this week?
I'm fine, and I didn't mean to paint light of your designation, a very important designation in the financial services industry. Just trying to set you apart. I need to come up with a good moniker or nickname for you. So we're going to work on that this year. How are you?
Hey, I definitely don't mind. The CFA takes, 3 to 4 or 5 years of people's lives. So definitely appreciate you mentioning it.
Absolutely. Well, it's a lot of work. And I think for anyone who is not familiar with that body of knowledge that you have to understand, it's pretty significant. It's almost the equivalent of a master's of science in finance, very detailed. So Devin, thanks for joining us. And we certainly appreciate your expertise, insight into what's happening. What's top of mind for you and the folks at the old clubhouse called LinkedIn?
Absolutely, Jeff. Definitely some great conversations on social media this week. The first one I'm going to mention, and some of your longtime listeners are going to think, Devin, you're bringing this up again, but I really do believe in the importance of repetition on this topic, and I think you will as well. A new report out this week from the GAO, that's the Government Accountability Office, finds that 48% of Americans 55 years and older have nothing stashed away for retirement. Mm. Now, this is a slightly down, I guess that's good news, from 52% the previous year. But look, obviously, it's not down enough. And it leaves nearly a third of these older Americans also with no pension, no 401k or IRA account. Another report out this week finds that 41% of pre-retirement households will basically run out of money later in life, and that's taking into account how long we in the U.S. are expected to live these days. So, bad statistics across the board. Again, it's not really news because we talk about it so much, but I think in terms of educating people, especially younger people, to these possibilities later in life, I think repetition is important. So we feature this report at the top of the LinkedIn feed this week. It got hundreds of comments, literally hundreds of comments from people talking about their approach, their plan B. We got financial advisors weighing in. So just wanted to mention it, and it's obviously an important topic.
Yeah. Well, if I had hair, I'd be pulling it out because it's so frustrating, to see these statistics year over year, because this isn't like a new phenomenon. I mean, this is something that obviously has been going on for quite some time, and it's just, for us, it's like, we're preaching to the choir here having this conversation. And I wonder, Devin, you have covered a story, not to change the subject, but I think it's similar. You covered a story about cybersecurity on the show maybe a month ago. And, I think the thesis was, does talking about it or does it lessen the impact of cybersecurity or data breaches by talking about it so much? And do we just tune it out? Just knowing what you took away from that conversation, what you covered, you think that could also be the case here? People are just like, let me bury my head in the sand like an ostrich.
That's a great point. And that may be a negative side effect to talking about it so much. And I think as we spoke about a few weeks ago, the real power I find in raising awareness is real world examples. So anecdotes, real stories. And I think I mentioned on that episode that we did that it's sometimes it's really difficult to read stories in the news about an elderly family or elderly couple running out of money. But I think those real world examples, making it real, is really important. And I think all these numbers that we talked about, actually, to your point, kind of do people start glossing over them. Yeah. And kind of it makes it easier to bury your head in the sand. So I guess making it real for people with examples and anecdotes is probably the way to go.
Yeah. And that was feedback that I think when we had our anniversary show,
right,
that was feedback that I think you had given and some other people had given and said, like, let's make this a real thing, because I think you're right.
Yeah.
I mean, not to go off on a tangent, because I know you have more to cover, but I think that when you are talking at such a high level, and I think we have a, you know, in our industry especially, you're talking about these things that, you know, the average person is smart to understand, but they don't, because they don't do this every day.
Yeah.
You actually tune it out, and who's going to,
yep,
you know, who's going to listen to, you should set your deferral at this, and you should, you know, your house is your biggest asset, and, you know, you should be saving at least double digits every year. I mean, you know, people tune that stuff out because it just, it's hard to comprehend. So let's see if we can do a better job of communicating.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Another story, we saw literally hundreds of comments and conversation on this week is, something we've also touched on in the past, which is the, you know, in this tight labor market full of millennials, companies are really looking for ways to stand out, for benefits to attract people. So, you know, things like free coffee, yoga classes, all that kind of stuff. But according to a new study done by MetLife, what workers these days want most among all these benefits is actually time off, and specifically unlimited paid vacation. We're starting to see this from a lot of companies. I'm fortunate enough to work for a company that gives unlimited paid time off. And this MetLife study found that 72% of young workers of the millennial generation, they treat unlimited paid time off as the number one benefit they would like. And that's on top of rewards for healthy living or free food or paid sabbaticals or on-site services like laundry, childcare, gym, et cetera. So something really, you know, interesting to think about, especially for people in management positions or corporate leaders. The data is showing that this is really what, in this tight labor market where people are competing for talent, this is something that really helps companies and businesses stand out.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting, not to, I don't even know how this relates, but you made me think about a subject a new NFL coach has inserted into his practices, time for technology, time for, you know, technology breaks where, you know, the kids, I mean, they're younger than me, right? So these players, they take a break during practice, they can go get their phones because they're itching for the phones. And I think it's kind of like you're adapting to the cultural changes, you know, because in the old world of the NFL, I mean, who the hell would let you go get a water break, much less check out your phone? I mean, these old school, you know, Tom Landry,
right?
You know, those guys are not going to make that happen. And I'm wondering if there's a little bit of a change in culture, because I think what you're suggesting is, you know, I think people want to work hard, but they also want to balance time, and I think how you do that is getting more time off potentially. You know, you don't want to feel guilty. I always felt guilty taking time off, and therefore I wouldn't take time off.
I know. Actually, there's some research out that shows unlimited paid time off leads employees to take less than they would if there was a set number of days, because of that sort of stigma attached to it. So it's tough. But and in some corporate cultures, and I'll just mention anecdotally here at LinkedIn, people are very much encouraged, and managers have to kind of lead the way and show that look, they're willing to take you know 2 weeks off at a time, 3 weeks off at a time, et cetera, or they're willing to use their full parental leave, you know, because they really have to lead by example. So definitely comes down to the culture and the leadership. And on that note of leadership, as you know, sometimes I like to end on kind of a softer note, but an important one. We saw so much conversation around this report from Quartz about how to be a boss. So a lot of people see themselves as a manager or a boss or a CEO in the future, but don't quite know how to get there, what skills to hone along the way. So this report just covers a lot of great basic skills to hone your management, your leadership experience. That includes learning how to run a meeting, learning how to give feedback properly to potential subordinates, learning how to recruit talent, how to have an eye to spot talent and then manage that recruitment process, and how to keep a team happy and productive. So they all sound kind of obvious, but when you write them down and work on them one at a time and track your progress, these are, I think, some great pieces of advice for those who see themselves in leadership positions in the future.
Yeah, and not just beginning leadership positions, but even people who are continuing to lead. I mean,
we
all make mistakes, and I think it's something you got to kind of revisit and remind yourself. I think, you know, reminding yourself to be humble, reminding yourself that you don't know everything, that, you know, it's a lot to be learned, and you can't know it all, and to be a good teammate as a leader as well, because you need those things.
That's definitely great advice. It's clear, Jeff, that you are an appropriate leader.
I don't know if I'm leading right now. I'm sitting here recording the show. I'm looking at two cats who apparently want to be led either to the litter box or to be fed. And I'm thinking that they want to be fed. Devin, always a pleasure. And folks, if you want to see the latest from Devin Banerjee, you can certainly follow him on LinkedIn. He's very available, always writing really interesting and thoughtful pieces. And you can also follow him on Twitter. He's a great person to follow, always in the know. And we certainly appreciate Devin and his input on the show. Devin, have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.
Take care, bye.
Welcome back, and that was a great segment, I thought, with Devin Banerjee talking about the social media trends on LinkedIn. And now let's turn our attention to technology, and we've got to welcome back the Motley Fool's tech reporter, Ms. Natalie Walters. And we have a very special guest, someone who's going to be joining our Motley crew, pun intended, Mr. Dan Klein, another technology reporter with the Motley Fool. Hey, guys, how are you?
Hey,
I'm doing
great.
How are you?
And you both are in sync. That's how in sync you guys are. You guys are like a chorus. Well, great to have you both. And Dan, pleasure to meet you. Before we get started, Dan, why don't you know, people know Natalie from the show and over the last year. Well, if you could spend a minute telling about yourself, all the great stuff you've covered. I know you worked for Microsoft at one point. You worked at the Boston Globe. So
sure,
give us the 30-second snapshot.
I am a lifelong journalist, aside from a brief detour spending 2 years running a really large toy store. At the Motley Fool, I handle a lot of our partner relationships. So my content is aimed at sort of a general audience. I am writing for USA Today and MSN and AOL and sort of all those partners. And I am actually part of Natalie's Motley Fool origin story.
So do tell. You can't leave us hang like that.
So it's not like I bit her with a radioactive spider or anything, but our boss, our editorial director, and I were looking for bright up-and-coming reporters, and Natalie kept coming across our screen. So we spent I would say a couple of months really trying to talk her into coming to join us, and we're very happy that she did.
Yeah. Natalie, how do you want to respond to that? I mean, we think you're fabulous here on the show. Obviously, Dan and the folks at Motley Fool do. Your readers and subscribers do. But we don't want to get your head too big, but how do you want to respond to that?
Yes, Dan was so great to talk to. I just wasn't sure about the switch to working, because I think it was like 23 or something at the time, and he was so great. And when I talked with him, he was so boisterous and energetic, and it was so exciting to join on. He's been so nice and helpful the whole time. He makes any topic interesting, you know. It's great.
Well, I appreciate that, but I'm sure coming up somewhere on this podcast, I will fail to make something interesting.
we're going to hold you to a high standard. So guys, Natalie, I'll start with you, and then we'll go to our newcomer and great contributor, Dan. What's top of mind for you and the folks at the Motley Fool this week?
Were you starting with me?
Yeah, I was going to start with you, Nat. Just
okay,
you know, you're the
sorry,
grizzled,
I
you're
heard
the grizzled.
Name.
Sorry,
yeah.
You're the grizzled podcast veteran on our show. So we'll start
yes.
with you. What's top of mind for you and the folks at the
of
Motley
course.
Fool?
So Apple had a big conference this week on March 25th, and they announced their new subscription services, which we've been expecting for a while now. You know, a big topic we've talked on the podcast about this past year is how Apple is needing to come up with other revenue streams because, you know, smartphones, the market has matured and, you know, the smartphones are basically staying the same. There's not much difference between each phone. You know, just yesterday, my little sister said, you know, which phone should I get? And I said, honestly, it doesn't really matter because they're about the same over the past 3 years. So maybe just go for the cheapest one that's come out recently. So because of that, Apple's iPhone revenue is taking a hit. So they're having to come up with other revenue options. And services is a huge one they've been focusing on sort of quietly in the background. And now we finally have all the information. And there's a lot of subscriptions coming to Apple. One is a gaming subscription called Apple Arcade. One is a new subscription called Apple News Plus. And they have a credit card company coming called Apple Card. And they also have their, you know, film TV subscription called Apple TV Plus. And they didn't release any of the pricing options except for Apple News, which will be about $10 a month. And so these are going to be some really great ways for Apple to make money, you know, because even with the new subscription, they're going to be keeping 50% of the profits, which is a lot. And you might think, well, which magazine or news company is going to want to do that kind of deal? You know, it seems like a ripoff, but you have to remember it's Apple, mm-hmm. and Apple is huge. And yeah. you think of all the people that have an iPhone, all the people that have an iPad or a MacBook. I mean, you would take the 50%. It's worth it for how many phones you're going to be on. And so Apple's really, you know, they're changing with the times and they're in a great position because as we've talked about over the past year, so many people have an iPhone. So even if they're not buying a new iPhone, it's going to be easy for them to click on subscribe to this, subscribe to this, subscribe to this.
Yeah. Well, so, yeah. I was going to say, Dan, if I'm Netflix, should I be worried?
No. So I don't want to be the pessimist here, but
wow.
Apple News is a great idea for 2004. the ship has sailed on magazines. So it comes with access to 300 magazines. And you could say, oh, my God, that's $8,000 value. But, Jeff, I don't know about you. Are you reading a couple hundred magazines a month or none?
Dude, I gotta tell you, I haven't read a physical magazine in probably 10 years.
I get Rolling Stone and I get Entertainment Weekly, and my combined spend on those is maybe $25.
Yeah.
And they talk about Apple News bundles in the Wall Street Journal and the Los Angeles Times, but it actually only has select content, which you could already find on sites like, say, MSN.com.
Yeah.
So, and then on the Netflix side, to answer your question, Apple trotted out some big name creators. Oprah is going to make a documentary. Mm. Oprah hasn't moved the needle except for the Oprah Winfrey Show. You could argue that she helped Weight Watchers until the name change. She was not a game changer for SiriusXM. And on SiriusXM, she had a branded channel. Here she has two documentaries. Steven Spielberg is going to be on, rebooting Amazing Stories, a show that wasn't that successful 30 years ago.
That's true.
They're entering a space that's absurdly crowded, and realistically, it comes down to IP. I have Netflix. I have Hulu.
Dan?
Marvel. They have an endless array of children's content. Apple is going to come and say, like, we have a show with James Corden and maybe Oprah's going to do something. It seems to me like a half-baked idea unless, and I think it's a big unless they give it away. And they have not talked at all about pricing. If you want to tie someone to their iPhone and your infrastructure, give them more stuff that makes it part of it, or make it an extra dollar on top of the Apple Music subscription. And then you have a real differentiator between Apple Music and Spotify. Mm-hmm. Right now, the credit card's kind of interesting, but I have a credit card. In fact, I have like 6 credit cards. The game service, is it that different from what anybody else is doing? You know, Google last week announced Stadia, which is a sort of higher-end version of that. I don't see a consumer populace that plays games that's willing to spend $10 a month, because that's not how kids play games. My son buys a $60 game and plays it for 3 to 6 months until his friends move on to something else. Mm-hmm. I don't see this big market for like playing a game for 20 minutes and then being able to access other ones.
Yeah. Go ahead, Nat. You want to respond?
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. I love that. That viewpoint on it. And I know what you're saying. It does seem a little bit dated a bit. It almost seems like, what you would expect, a bit out of a touch company to come up with in a way. And it's funny you mentioned the magazine thing, because I was just at a friend's house this morning and she had a Marie Claire magazine on the table. And she said, they just keep sending this to me. I don't even subscribe to it. I don't even know why they send it. And then she was like, I just throw it away every month. It's like, I don't read the magazines anymore. I can find all the content I want online for free, and I don't need to sit here with a physical magazine. And all of us at the table said none of us read magazines, and I can't even remember the last time I subscribed to a magazine. So I would kind of agree with you there.
I feel like
I already have Netflix, which is great for me. And like you said, I mean, Apple doesn't really have much to show for TV shows yet. They had that a few shows come out last year, but none of them did very well.
And it's a question of time. So I'm an Amazon Prime subscriber because of free shipping. And there are shows that I would watch on Amazon Prime. The second I get through the 3,000 shows I want to watch on Netflix, then I will get, I am in season 4 of Arrow and there's 9 seasons. It's going to take me like another year just to get through that one, let alone, and my wife uses it, and, my son who's 15 uses it. And I like magazines, and I would pay $3.99 a month for access to magazine quality journalism on my phone. But $9.99, you start looking at this, all piles up. Now, if you could bundle an arcade, an Apple television, whatever they're calling it, and music and news and all these things, and it's $19.99, maybe there's a value proposition. Yeah. But I can't imagine what television show Apple could create that would make me say I'm going to fork over more money when I'm already sort of begrudgingly about to give Disney whatever they want for Disney Plus.
And they did say that Apple is working with Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston on that morning drama show, which could be good. Reese is really big right now. She has her production company that really focuses on women's stories and female employees. With like Big Little Lies, that was a huge hit for them. So that could be good. And then, but also you mentioned Amazon, and Amazon has a deal with Jordan Peele, and he's huge right now.
Does CBS All Access. They've got the new Twilight Zone coming out with Jordan Peele.
Yes. So I mean, Apple has big names, but maybe they're not the most relevant. Jordan Peele is this new, fresh director with new, fresh ideas and this day and age when there's so much content, it really has to be original and new for people to be interested in it.
But guys, we'll continue this conversation ongoing. But I just want to say, I think the future, and I want to get you, I want you guys to think about it between this week and next week. The future is in aggregation, because for someone to go out and buy Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime, I have all three, then by Disney, then by Marvel, then by Apple. I think that the wave of the future, I'd rather share revenue with someone and have lots of content and have you visit my site and use the content than have you go and, I just don't think people are going to pay $20 a month or $15 a month for all these different outlets. That's just my thesis, and I want to get your opinion on that next week if we could.
Yeah. Works for me.
Guys, thank you so much. Natalie, always a pleasure. Dan, welcome to the show. We love having your opinion, and we'll catch you all next week right here on the Pulse.
Thank you.
Bye,
guys.
Bye.
Well, welcome back, and now time for our market segment. I want to welcome back to the program the lead anchor for the TD Ameritrade Network, Mr. Oliver Rennick. Hey, Oliver.
Yo, what up?
Hey, what up, my brother? And a brother from another mother from New York City, the chief executive officer for Delphi Digital. You like that, Kevin? Mr. Kevin Kelly. Hey, bud.
What's good, Jeff? What's good?
What's going on, my guys? So, it's the end of the quarter. Today's the last trading day of the quarter. So, might as well, I think it is, right? Yeah, today's the 29th.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, why don't you guys give us your take? I know, Oliver, I want to hear about all the great guests you had this week. You launched a new show with Nicole Pedalides here in New York. We'll start with you, Ollie, and then we'll get to you, Kevin. You can give us the crypto download.
Yeah, thanks for the new show shout out, courtesy Nicole. It's going well. They have a really great start to the week, talking a lot about the big market themes. Lyft is obviously a big one today with this IPO finally hitting the market. They talked quite a bit about the resilience of stocks this week with some of the top analysts on. So it's been really good. Really proud of it. Another great entry into the lineup. As far as markets go, there is. It's pretty interesting stuff going on, per usual. It's been a little bit quiet in terms of volume this week, but in terms of stories and the way the market is behaving is, I guess always kind of interesting to me. But a few things to point out just real quick is, one, you basically, have a continued focus on the bond market, which continues to rally. But we did get a little bit of a relief here the past couple sessions as we're talking on Friday. But even, relief or no relief, stocks have been pretty calm for the most part throughout what some would describe as recessionary signals in the bond market and stuff. So there's a debate raging how literal we should be in the rally and things like treasuries and, safety being sought for bonds and all that stuff, and if it's recessionary. So I'm not the economist and I don't know, but there's strong cases to be made on both ends. What we do know is that since the central bank turned very dovish and brought their view of interest rates in line with the markets, or at least closer in line, they're still not quite in line, markets generally liked it, especially some of the stuff you might expect. Growth tech names have been doing very well, but there's also a little bit of a nuance within the trade this time around, which is investors are still more interested in companies that have clear cash flow visibility, solid balance sheets. I don't think a lot of people know that in terms of factors, you have high-quality companies actually doing better than pure growth and momentum plays. Those are usually defined as stocks with fairly clean balance sheets and good cash flow. So you've got cloud companies that are rocking because they have pretty high margins and stuff like that. So there's some interesting things going on, but there still is a big waiting game to see how all the macroeconomic stuff plays out. Next week, lots of data. That's where we'll pick it up.
Yeah, so Kevin, GDP numbers revised down. But I want you to build on what Oliver had to say, and then let's talk a little crypto too while we get, and then we can get Ali's reaction to that.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's building off what Oliver said. With the revision downward in GDP, a lot of that coming from the consumer. You still have that trend of global economies at this point are starting to slow for certain. The U.S. for a long time kind of looks like, and I think still does look like, this safe haven where, we're not sounding the alarm bells, even though, to Ali's point, you have had this quick, inversion in part of the curve, at least here at the U.S. Treasury market. It is important to note, though, even in historical times, times prior, I guess you could say, when you've had a yield curve inversion, you really don't see the economy roll over or get into a recession for, at least another 12 to 15 months, similar to the stock market peaking. So you can have a period where, yields potentially even, rise or steepen here and stocks continue to do well before, you really, really sound the alarm bells. But I think to Oliver's point, it seems a little bit different. And I know he's talked a good amount about how this compares to, the 2016, early 2016, sell-off in stocks, and how, there are some certain, situations or indicators that say it's similar to that time, but there's also some that say, we are certainly later in the cycle. I think it's definitely this risk-on move, to his point, here in the first quarter, but at the same time, it does seem almost kind of like a defensive risk-on move where, yes, stocks are still in favor, but to Oliver's point, you're looking at the quality of these companies, and you're not really going super far out the risk spectrum. You're getting into these growth names because, again, if you expect economic growth to slow, you want to look for growth somewhere else, and some of these growth stocks are certainly the place to get that. But it feels, at least to me, it's this kind of more defensive risk-on trade than kind of the pure, floodgates are open and risk is back on the table.
So thanks for that, Kevin. So now let's shift a little bit to crypto. I've been reading, we've talked a lot over the last quarter about cryptocurrency, some of the developments there. I bring up again Venezuela and the Bolivar. advising people to move the cryptocurrency. I saw a great article yesterday or the day before about a soccer team that was supposed to be paid in cryptocurrency, but is actually still being paid in fiat. So why don't you break down crypto for us, and then we'll get Oliver's reaction.
Yeah, I mean, broadly speaking, I mean, looking at Bitcoin, and you know, certainly had a decent quarter compared to what you saw in the fourth quarter, where, again, this kind of risk-off indicator. I mean, I certainly think that Bitcoin continues to be viewed far out the risk spectrum, a lot farther than most people would consider, because, again, it's a very, it's a bet on a still emerging technology with crypto in general. But at the same time, if you think about it as kind of publicly traded VC in a sense, it is much more liquid than, getting out of certain private equity or venture capital deals. So, you would expect that, kind of when the market sells off, you see, equity market volatility surge, that certain things that are farther out the risk spectrum, like Bitcoin, would certainly see, a sell-off as well. And that's pretty much what we've seen. And so then, the subsequent recovery, in this first quarter, I mean, Bitcoin, certainly hasn't broken out. It's still trading that kind of roughly around 4,000 range. But I think there is, the sentiment that continues to proliferate in this market, and especially from the clients that we've talked to, where, you are moving away from this narrative of, Bitcoin and all crypto is dead to, okay, obviously there's still a lot of junk in the space, but there are a lot of really interesting use cases. There is some utility that's actually coming to this. Whether it's Bitcoin being used in developing nations or some of these interesting projects that are coming to market that are actually, being used by people. I mean, the adoption still, it's still slow. But at the same time, it's people are becoming less and less, I guess, skeptical and trying to see where this actual value opportunity is here. And a lot of people we've talked to, have actually considered the bottom of Bitcoin to be in. Not to say that you're going to hit 20,000 per Bitcoin, tomorrow or next month or even next year. I expect that rise to be much, much more, subtle and what you would expect in a more mature market. But it is still kind of this risk on type indicator where, if we think that global central bank policy is going to be more kind of on the dovish side, not only just here in the US, but also, in Europe, the ECB, the BOJ continues to just pump, massive amounts of liquidity in the market. If you have those situations and that continues, then I think, Bitcoin and crypto assets certainly can get a bid because that search for yield and that search for growth is going to be, kind of top of mind for investors.
Oliver?
I think it's an interesting case. If you got a little bit of a lift in Bitcoin at the end of the week, I mean, it hasn't really broken out of this range it's been in. So if you, think that lower volatility and lower beta is a positive for it as being a more stable asset, then I think, it's pretty interesting to think about that. One of the things that we talked about very early on as people were talking about this as an investment case and stuff, it's just nobody, unless you're going after something specifically for volatility, the giant swings it was having, probably not a good thing by most measurements. And I mean, yeah, now that it's gotten pretty quiet and has had a tighter trading range, I mean, it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of liquidity or volume behind it. And there's a pretty damning report about wash trading and fake Bitcoin and exchanges and all that stuff. So, I mean, I don't have any insight into that, but there needs to be clarity on it. But, I mean, if it's just naturally, quieting down a little bit, I think that's probably a positive thing for it.
Yeah. Well, guys, thank you so much. Hope you have a great weekend. How's the weather out in I can tell the weather is going to be nice here in New York City, Oliver. How's the weather out there in Chicago?
It's beautiful.
Oh, yeah?
It's just – it's really stunning, 50-degree weather, 47, sorry. So, yeah, we'll probably be at the beach this weekend.
There you go. Well, guys, thanks so much for joining us, and he got me, all right. So that's our brother from another mother, Mr. Kevin Kelly from Delphi Digital, and the lead anchor for the TD Ameritrade Network, Mr. Oliver Rennick. Guys, have a great weekend, and we'll check back in with you next week.
Thanks,
guys. Good to see you, Jeff.
Bye. Welcome back, and it's time now for our healthcare segment. And joining me on the line is the senior healthcare reporter for Business Insider, Miss Lydia Ramsey. Hey, Lydia, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, trying to stay out of the rain here in New York City, obviously, as you are, and hoping that we get some spring, nice, warmer spring weather. But otherwise, doing great.
Here's hoping.
Yeah, well, here's open is right. So thanks for joining us. And this is our healthcare segment. So, you know, we're not normally a healthcare centric show, but our show is about retirement and finance. And as you know, and many people know, healthcare is a huge component of both of those things. So we're very pleased to have you join us. So what's been, you know, you cover the healthcare segment, all aspects of it. You've been doing it for quite some time. What's top of mind for you and the folks at Business Insider this week with regards to healthcare?
Sure. So I guess a lot of stuff this week kind of came out on the drug front. On Tuesday, we had an approval for a new postpartum depression drug. So that was really interesting. My colleague, Erin Broadwin, kind of covered that. It's this drug that's called Zulresso, and it's, it's an infusion. So women who are experiencing postpartum depression can get it, you know, for a couple of days in the hospital. It comes with a pretty high price tag of $34,000, but it's a really interesting treatment because it's really interesting in the sense that you only have to take it once. So it's one of those, someone compared it, I think their CEO once compared it almost to like a course of antibiotics as opposed to, you know, an SSRI or something where you take it chronically.
Wow. Very interesting. And that's obviously, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I was going to make the comment that that's obviously a very critical part or postpartum of pregnancy, and many women have that serious condition, and hopefully they can take this drug. Hopefully it's covered by some level of insurance, because $35,000 seems like a tremendous amount of money.
yeah, for sure. That's going to be the sticking point. And I hopefully that pans out. I mean, it'll be an hospital-administered drug, so theoretically that could get some more coverage.
Excellent.
But yeah, then on the flip side of that, the other big story that kind of came out this week was yesterday when Biogen announced that it was going to stop its phase 3 trial of its Alzheimer's drug. So that was a rough day for Biogen. I think their stock ended up losing about $18 billion in market cap on that big failure.
So this, and then for those on the, who are listening to the show, you know, obviously you go through drug trials and there's different stages. What was this drug supposed to be doing?
Yeah, so Biogen and a few other big companies, you know, Merck was trying this too, and I believe it was Lilly. A lot of folks kind of had this idea that if you could clear out the amyloid plaques that kind of accumulate in the brain, which have, you know, we've looked at scans and stuff, and people have said, okay, in patients with Alzheimer's, there seems to be this accumulation of this protein in the brain, this amyloid protein. So if we clear it, maybe we could, you know, slow progression, you know, maybe reverse some of the kind of symptoms associated with Alzheimer's. Still not a cure level or reversal level, but the idea was to kind of slow things down. But so far, the field has been totally littered with failures. Merck canceled a couple of its trials. Lilly canceled it too. So this is kind of the next in line. People have been kind of really holding out for this one to kind of pan out, but it hasn't.
Yeah, that's certainly a disease that inflicts many, many Americans, especially many older Americans. And, you know, we're always looking at drugs to extend our lives. People are living longer. This is another area where this could be so helpful and remedy something that was really debilitating for many families.
Right. And yeah, and this is kind of the last of the late stage trial results to come out over the next couple of years. There's a couple more folks that are going into some phase 3 trials. So maybe we'll start to see some data from that. But it's definitely a lot of big space for someone to come in and figure it out someday, hopefully.
Fingers are crossed.
Yeah.
So any other top issues before we go to our next topic?
I think that was it. But the biggest thing for me was, you know, watching everyone kind of absorb some of the Theranos coverage that's been coming out lately.
Yeah. And so I'm glad you brought
that up. Happy to talk about that.
Yeah. You know, I'm glad you brought that up. So in our tech segment, Natalie Walters, who I know you know, loves Netflix documentaries, loves all these series. And we talk about this on a regular basis and not necessarily Theranos. And it's kind of interesting. I wanted to get your take on this because there were two documentaries. One that's more well-known, Alpha Blood, which was on HBO on Monday, whatever date that was. That was probably the 18th, I would guess. Monday the 18th is when it debuted, and it's still available on HBO to go and all those other services. And then there was one on ABC 2020 or one of those other shows that aired on the Friday before. So Theranos obviously is a big, huge issue. Would you mind just kind of describing for the audience just basically what happened?
Yeah, definitely. So the basic story of Theranos, and I'm sure you've dived into this a bit in the past, but to recap, back in, 2013, 2014, there was this huge biotech unicorn that seemingly came out of nowhere and had this big vision of, we can take a few drops of blood from a finger prick and we can test it for all these different conditions. And people went wild for it. Their CEO, Elizabeth Holmes, she was a big deal. She was on the cover of, Fortune and New York Times Magazine and Forbes, and she was really everywhere. And all of a sudden, she had this big thing that she was really young. She was the youngest female billionaire, and she owned about half of the stake of this $9 billion company. But turns out, when folks started asking questions and some people from the company started speaking out against it, the Wall Street Journal's John Carreyrou got wind of all this and realized that they didn't have the breakthrough technology that they claimed they did. So that's when things started unraveling. Then came all of the investor lawsuits and investigations from the FDA and the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. So a lot of that started happening. And then by 2018, things really started to kind of come to a point. The SEC charged Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos with massive fraud. They settled it, but the former president, Sonny Balwani, is still going to court over that. And then in June, the Department of Justice laid down some criminal charges against both Elizabeth Holmes and Sonny Balwani. So that trial is still awaiting. We need to figure out. I think they're coming to court again in April. So
yeah, and it's a great documentary by Alex Gibney, who has done many other documentaries for both HBO and Netflix. I guess since you're that debuted Friday, the two documentaries debuted Friday and this past Monday the 18th. What have you gotten any feedback? Have people that you've talked to in the field given you any feedback as to that, or in general, what's the feedback to Theranos? I mean, I would imagine there are a lot of lessons to be learned there, both from like valuing a company, governance, all those kind of things. But what is the takeaway here?
Yeah, I guess a lot of folks, Bad Blood was a book written by John Carreyrou that came out this past May, and it's a really great primer of kind of the whole saga as it unfolded. What I really liked personally about, I got to talk to Alex Gibney about this too. It was really fun to kind of see. He late in the process got a lot of leaked footage, about 100 hours worth, mm-hmm. of just, B-roll of Elizabeth walking around the Theranos headquarters, of her dancing, of her celebrating an FDA approval by going into a bounce house, crazy stuff, but stuff we hadn't really seen before. And it's interesting, upon kind of hearing reactions, one of the biggest takeaways, which I wouldn't have expected because I've been covering her and I've heard her speak in the past, but her voice is quite deep and it really threw people off when they first heard that in the documentary. So that's been pretty fun. But it's an interesting story. I was talking to one of her early professors who kind of shot her down almost immediately back in 2002, and she had one of her original ideas. She was telling me, we were talking, I was like, okay, now that we've had this, huge example, this huge flame out, billion or million, hundreds of millions of dollars for investors were lost. Are we going to see this ever again? And the professor was, a little bit more optimistic than I would be, that I think this was a big kind of outlier, I'd say, where we might not see a bunch of these cases of fraud hopefully hit the healthcare sector anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, so. God, I mean, it's so critical. You have people's lives depending on drugs, on healthcare services, and you would hate for something like this to happen again. I was really impressed, right. or not impressed, or shocked at the influential people that were kind of surrounding her. And, I don't know if that had, that lowered the guard for many people in terms of doing due diligence and making sure that they were actually doing what they said they were going to do. And the technology was in place to do that. And the deal with Walgreens made sense. And it was very interesting. I don't know if you saw the Fire Festival documentaries, because there actually are two documentaries on that. And
right.
I mean, very different topics, but
Yeah.
Kind of similar in that moving very quickly to get something in place with Fyre. They were trying to get a festival together in like 4 or 5 months, which is unreal. Mm-hmm. And then with Theranos, where they were just kind of, breaking things, Silicon Valley Metro, to break things and try to make this thing happen. Then this was over a long period of time, so the company had been around for a while. I really, in my head, and I want to get your feedback on this, drew some distinctions between the Fyre documentaries and Theranos. Very similar in a lot of ways.
Yeah, my biggest parallel between the two, and I got to talk to Alex about this as well, was just how much footage both, Billy McFarland over at Fyre and Elizabeth Holmes at Theranos kind of collected on themselves. It was really shocking to me to kind of see how well documented they kind of captured their early days when there was buzz and there was excitement. So I think the big thing that's going to be coming out of, the next couple years and kind of we look at it, is kind of like the psychology of how this could unfold, which is pretty hard to speculate on, but it's interesting to kind of see both of these really monumental characters kind of commit these big level fraud, flame out situations. Certainly they're not alone. So
yeah, well, more to come on the judicial and legal proceedings, and hopefully no more to come in terms of these types of events. Lydia, always a pleasure talking with you, or a pleasure meeting you and a pleasure talking with you. And I look forward to having you back on the show again very soon. Excellent coverage. And have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.
Take care. Bye. Well, welcome back. And now it's time for our personal finance/retirement segment. And on the line with me is the retirement reporter, for MarketWatch, Ms. Alessandra Melito. Hi, Allie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's going to be a nice weekend here in New York, as you know, and I'm excited for that. I'm excited for spring. It's baseball season, although my Orioles didn't do too well, and they're not very good this year. They weren't good last year, and they probably won't be good for the next 5 years. But other than that, I'm doing great, and you're back from a nice vacation. So welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So it's good to hear your voice. And so what's top of mind for you and the folks at MarketWatch this week?
So for me as the retirement reporter, I would say that it's just important to talk about auto enrollment. So I love auto enrollment. The concept of it is great. Just going to make a disclaimer that I'm a huge fan of this because I wrote a story that said otherwise.
Okay.
So auto enrollment is basically when you start working at a new company and they automatically put you into their retirement account, which is a great thing because that means that that's one less thing, less paperwork and all that stuff for the new employee. And it also means that they are starting to save for retirement, whether they know how much that is or not. And usually the deferral rate is like 3% or something like that, which comes out of their paycheck. So that's great. But there is a downside to it. Mm-hmm. And that's basically that sometimes people get wrapped up in the suggestion, or rather the default rate that the company gives you. So if the deferral rate is 3%, that's great if you're just starting out, you've never saved for retirement before or whatever. But when you start to take it as a suggestion and then you don't ever change that deferral rate, you're actually hurting yourself and your future retirement savings because 3% is not going to cut it when you are doing that every year for, 30 years. Financial advisors suggest that you should have 10%, 12%, 15%, and some people say even more, like above 20%. Mm. And if you aren't adjusting that rate either right at the beginning or every year thereafter when, you get more money in raises and bonuses and things like that, you could be hurting yourself and significantly undersaved for retirement.
Yeah, really, really interesting. Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to say, Allie, that you are speaking my language because I am a fan, like yourself, of auto enrollment, auto escalation. I think those are great tactics, but I do think that we need to have that mix, those plan design features mixed with ways to engage people because, as you just said, inertia, which auto enrollment was designed to eliminate or at least subside, can set in if you just keep everything at 3% or 4%. And, you know, I think it's something that plan sponsors, employers have to be wary of, and participants have to be wary of, individuals have to be wary of. So I'm in agreement with
you. Yeah, and a lot of participants, when they hear that the company put them in for 3% or something like that, a lot of them take it either as a suggestion, the company is saying this is how much you should be putting away for your 401k, and then other people are considering it just the norm. Well, if my company said it, then it must be the right thing to do. The good news with auto enrollment is that when somebody is automatically enrolled in a plan, they're more likely to stay in the plan. I went to this event for the Center for State and Local Government Excellence, and they had done a story that found that 3/4 of employees stay in their public sector supplemental retirement plan, which is, you know, similar to a 401k where you can be automatically enrolled and all that stuff. And they stayed in the plan. The study looked at 400 full-time state and local government workers, and they asked them various questions. So they broke them up into 3 groups. One group was getting a default contribution rate of 1%, another group was getting 4%, and another group was getting 7%. Not everybody decided to increase the rate, but those who did, about half, said that they would increase the rate because it wasn't enough, which is great. That's a good instinct. But they weren't doing as much as they were supposed to be doing or what advisors would say they should be doing. So the 1% group upped it to 5.4% on average. Those in the 4% group increased their contribution rate to 6.6%. And those in the 7% group increased it, but only to 7.6%. And that's, you know, it's great that they've decided to increase their contribution rate, or that, you know, that's what they would do if given this opportunity. But it's still nowhere near like the 15% that you should be putting in if you can afford it. So it's just important to note that while you should be thankful that your company is doing it, because not all companies do this, it doesn't mean that you should rely just on that contribution rate, or that you should just take it at face value.
Yeah.
Your company is doing it because obviously they don't want to put 20% of your paycheck into a 401k or something like that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't take the initiative to do just a little bit more. And the good news is you don't actually have to do too much paperwork. Not like if you had to, you know, sit at your desk, get up, go to HR and figure out how to open up a 401k. You got that down. It's just a matter of, you know, taking an extra step to save yourself down the road.
Yeah, I mean, look at your, if I'm a participant in a retirement plan or an individual, look at my retirement statement. And then at least once a year, right, I think that the rule of thumb is at least once a year, examine your asset allocation to make sure you're in line with your current goals, because goals change as you age and mature, theoretically. And also making sure that your contribution rate is what it should be, and are you on track. And lots of companies, retirement plan companies, and also independent firms have calculators. I would imagine that can help you calculate your needs and budgets and et cetera.
Yeah, and also, so some companies, not only do they do auto enrollment, but they do auto escalation, which is another thing that if your company isn't offering it, you should be doing it yourself. Basically, every year or whenever you get a raise, you increase your contribution rate. Even if it's just 1%, just doing something so that you are saving more helps. Some people say as soon as you hear that you're getting a raise, that you should increase the contribution rate, because then you don't see the extra money in your paycheck, and then you won't feel the need to not do anything about retirement savings. But that's not for everybody. Maybe people do need a little bit extra money, and that, you know, money that they're getting in a raise can help them with their daily responsibilities and stuff like that. That's fine. But just try to put a little bit extra every time you get this windfall, because it will, of course, make you more comfortable in retirement. Because as we all know, it is not just about a house, you know, or giving money to the kids or things like that. It's very much about healthcare and medical expenses. And those could be extremely expensive, and they're only getting more expensive. And it also, the cost of healthcare rises as you age. So a lot of people don't take that into consideration when they are calculating how much they're going to need for retirement. They're just thinking about, you know, the fun stuff, which they should be thinking about. But
yeah, it's a balancing act. And don't do the, at the top of the show, we're talking about being an ostrich and putting your head in the sand. And, you know, you really can't afford to do that no matter what your age in terms of your saving and planning. It's best, you know, it's break it up into little chunks and do what you can today and plan for tomorrow, because you've got to be an active participant. Love that you told the story, and I love that you love auto enrollment, but you're willing to challenge the status quo, Allie, and to make things better and make things happen. So thanks for that great insight, and we appreciate, as always, yours and Jacob's contribution to the show, and wish you both, I know he's not on the line, but wish you both a great weekend, and we'll talk to you all hopefully next week.
Yes, definitely. Thank
Take
you.
Care. Bye-bye. Well, it's time for our legal segment, and, you know, they are the retirement rock stars, and joining me on the line is one of the legal eagles, Mr. David Levine. He's a principal with Groom Law Group, chartered in Washington, D.C. Hey, David, how are you?
I am doing wonderfully, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I should just say that Kevin Walsh is unable to join due to a conflict, a work conflict, not a conflict at work. So we're very happy to have you, David. Lots going on, obviously, in Washington, D.C., maybe not necessarily related to retirement plans, but what's top of mind for you and the folks at Groom Law this week?
Top of mind this week is watching the news. And when you watch the news, what did we see this week? We saw a ruling on something unrelated to retirement. Mm. It was healthcare. It was the ruling by a court in the last day on association health plans, the guidance that was sort of the forerunner of the association retirement plans, or the MEP guidance, as many people just refer to it. Mm-hmm. Now, everybody's still digesting that decision, but basically, a judge effectively struck down a whole chunk of the association health plan guidance, which allowed employers to pool together. What does it mean for association retirement plan guidance, which everybody submitted comments on back in December? We're going to have to see, but it's important to keep in mind that the regulatory challenges, whether it's a Democrat in the White House and Republicans challenging on the other side or vice versa, keep on going. So that could continue to stall the regulatory train, but we'll have to see where it lands. So where does that take us? Where it takes us is to, well, what's going on in Congress? Mm. We know we talk all the time about, hey, we're going to talk about RESA over and over and over again. And everybody who's a listener, thank you for listening to that. We're not going to rehash RESA yet again, but things are moving yet again. As we've said before, we don't know where this lands, but it's good to tell people what's going on right now. Yeah. So coming up in early April, we expect the Ways and Means Committee. While they're also focusing on IRS reform, the RESA package is back on the table. There is going to be hearings, I believe, held and discussion, and we're going to see what moves forward. As we talked about before, the devil is in the details. It seems like there might be some agreement between the House and the Senate. And it's not worth walking through all the little nuances, yes, to where we started our discussion a minute or two ago. Open MEPs are still in there, not much change, but there's a chance it could start moving forward again. But as we've all learned over the past several years, 5 years is a short period of time to get legislation done, and a little tongue-in-cheek, but the reality is things could easily get delayed. Yeah. But it's going to be back on the table in discussion, so be watching for that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the big news in Washington this week. Obviously, a lot more could be coming, and as we look into April and tax filing season and everything, everybody's starting to look. And I'll just give a little side note for today. For those of you who live in states that have they're now subject to the itemized deduction limit for SALT, state and local income taxes, the IRS did come out with some guidance about how figuring out how your tax refunds impact your taxes as well, your state tax refunds. So for on the individual level, take a look at that because it might impact your taxes as you go forward.
Yeah, well, thanks, David. And that's a great suggestion, especially since tax day is right around the corner, unfortunately. I guess we should be excited. I'm excited. Look, there's a lot going on in Washington, D.C. this week. We won't talk about it on the show. But I'm really excited that retirement has bubbled up to the surface. You know, that's top of mind for us on the show. And all of us contributing to the show believe in people saving for retirement. So I'm excited at least that these conversations are happening. And, you know, we're trying to get more people saving in and outside retirement plans. So I think it's all good news.
Agreed. Thanks for having us, Jeff.
All right. Have a great weekend, David, and we'll catch up with you next week.
Thank you, Jeff. Have a good one.
Bye. Well, folks, I don't know what to tell you. We've kind of come to the end of the show. I know it's hard to believe. You know, time just flies when you're having fun. Thanks for joining us, of course. And I want to say thanks to Lydia Ramsey from Business Insider. Excellent, excellent analysis of what's going on in healthcare. You know, healthcare is an important component to any financial preparedness and retirement plan. And I'm really happy that Lydia was able to join us. We hope to have her back at least on a monthly basis to deliver the news. Thanks to all of our contributors, and welcome to Mr. Dan Klein from The Motley Fool. He was our special guest on the program in the tech segment, and he brings a wealth of knowledge and a very interesting perspective on technology. And thanks to you, our audience. Without you, why else would we do this, even though we do enjoy talking about these issues? So enjoy the rest of your weekend wherever you are. Hope the weather is just so fine and you're enjoying spring. And we'll tune in with you next week as we go around the globe analyzing the issues related to retirement, the markets, technology, personal finance, healthcare, so much more, right here on The Weekly Pulse.